This is Robert Scheinfeld, and welcome to the second segment of Chats with Fascinating People. If you found your way to this segment and you have not already experienced the first segment, be sure to go back to the source where you got this particular audio, or visit robertscheinfeld.com, check on the Resources tab, and you'll be able to download all of the ones that you may be missing if the group somehow got separated. That's robertscheinfeld.com, robertscheinfeld.com, and the Resources tab to get the additional segments. Robert Scheinfeld here with another episode of what I'm calling my Chats with Fascinating People series. And today I'm on the phone with a good friend and a longtime friend named Gay Hendricks, who I actually met, I don't know exactly, I would guess 20-something years ago when I went to one of his relationship seminars with his wife. And then we really didn't interact very much for a long time, and then kind of rediscovered each other about 6 years ago at the time of this recording, and have mutual admiration society for each other's work. Today we're going to talk about two aspects of things that are foremost on Gay's mind at the moment. One is a new book that he just released called The Big Leap, and then also his conscious relationship work. So welcome to the series, Gay. It's a pleasure to be doing this with you.
Well, thank you, and what an honor to be regarded as a fascinating person. How's that?
So let's begin, Gay, with your book, The Big Leap. It's got a lot of really amazing stuff in it. I really enjoyed the book myself, but there are two main big ideas that are kind of the foundation of the book. Why don't you tell us what those are?
Yes. The first big idea is what I call the upper limit problem. And for about the past 30 or 35 years, I've really studied how and why people sabotage themselves when they've exceeded their own upper limit of how much love and positive energy and success they can experience. And so The Big Leap is about how to understand the upper limit problem and why you do it, and most particularly how to transcend the upper limit problem so that you can go as far as you want to go without the need to limit yourself or sabotage yourself. So the dynamics of the upper limit problem are the first major thing that The Big Leap is about. The second thing that it's about is how ultimately to spend your time and organize your time once you've transcended your upper limit problem. And that's in the zone of genius. And I describe four different zones in the book: the zone of incompetence, the zone of competence, the zone of excellence, and the zone of genius. And The Big Leap is about how to discover what your zone of genius is and how to move into that zone of genius and ultimately live your whole life from it. So the upper limit problem, number one, and number two, the zone of genius. Those are the two big concepts that the book revolves around.
Well, there are so many people out there that have things that they want to experience. I call it things that they want to change, fix, or improve about their lives. And if you were to talk to a lot of people and just talk about it, they would say, I don't have any upper limit. I would be more than happy to take any amount of positive whatever. What the hell are you talking about? So what is it, given the fact that everybody would say, I don't have any limit, I'd be happy to accept whatever, and yet everybody still does. So what's going on underneath? What are the fears or the forces that are going on inside of everybody that even though they would say and don't want to have any limit, certainly, and yet they still do?
Yes. Well, it's kind of like what would happen if you interviewed a fish and asked the fish, do you have any sense, Mr. Fish, of how water is limiting you? I know you make good use of it, but do you have any sense of how water is limiting you as far as what you can experience in the world? And the fish, of course, would say, No, you know, that's because from the fish's perspective, that's the way it goes. And they're playing the water game over and out. So here on Earth, we have some other options, though, because we can play the breathe in the air game and walk around on the ground game and the swim in the water game. So what we all have to do, and by the way, I've worked with upwards of 1,000 executives now, and many of those folks are very stubborn folks, and I haven't met any of them yet that didn't have the upper limit problem, didn't have themselves locked into their, locked out of their zone of genius and still locked in their zone of excellence. But I found only about half of them, when I explain it to them, immediately kind of get it and say, wow, I see how that applies. I'd say about 50% really have to argue and kind of make the claim, well, wait a minute, I'm operating at the top of my game. So that's one of the things that's important in life. And one of the points I make also in The Big Leap is the importance of openness to learning in life. You know, some of the most successful people I've ever worked with are the least defensive. Like I tell some stories about working with Michael Dell down at Dell Computer and other executives of his executive team when I used to do some consulting down there back in the 90s. And Michael is one of the most amazingly open to learning human beings I've ever seen. I mean, he doesn't spend a split second being defensive about anything. And the results speak for themselves. You know, he was a 100 millionaire by the time he was in his mid-20s and, you know, a multi-billionaire now and still doing well. And so he's a good example for me of a hallmark principle of life, which is being open to learning. So actually, when I get resistance from an executive or anybody that I'm working with, I usually kind of work on that whole openness to learning component even before I put any of the principles to work in The Big Leap, because I know they're not going to stick unless the person is sincerely interested in learning from the interactions they have. But specifically to look into the fears that are underneath the upper limits problem, there are four main ones that particularly successful people feel. One of them is the fear of outshining other people. And these are all unconscious fears that usually got installed when we were kids in reference to our brothers and sisters or other kids our age rather than in reference to our parents. So a lot of gifted kids get a message to not be too open to their genius. Don't display their genius too much because it'd be threatening to the other people. It would outshine other people and make them feel bad. So I can't count the number, hundreds of people that I've worked with as grown-ups later were limiting their grown-up success because they had that still that fear of outshining a brother or a sister or someone from their early childhood. A second fear is a lot of people I've worked with, even though they're very successful, have a fear of becoming even more successful or opening more to their creativity because they're afraid that they're already a burden in the world in some fashion. They've gotten what I say, convicted of an imaginary crime called being a burden when they're kids. And so for some reason or the other, somebody in their family perceived them as a burden and regarded them that way. And therefore, they kind of picked up that sense of I'm a burden down inside themselves. So later on in life, when they start being more successful, it kind of acts as a set of brakes on that because they think, okay, if I went all the way to my full success, I'd be just more of a burden to other people. So that's a second big one. A third big one is the fear of going all the way to your full potential for fear of abandoning or being disloyal to other people around you, particularly people in your past. And so sometimes we grow up in such a way that we become afraid that if we really showed our true genius, we would have to be disloyal to our roots or leave behind other people that weren't as gifted. The fourth fear is the most comprehensive one, though, that many of us carry around, and that is a fear of somehow being unworthy or a fear of being flawed in some kind of way. And so what happens is later on in life, if you're carrying that old unconscious fear that you're flawed in such a way, in some way, as you get more successful, you'll find ways to sabotage that success to kind of bring you back down to where you were before, or if you have suddenly made a lot of money or had some big breakthrough, what will happen then is you'll find a way not to enjoy it out of that feeling of being fundamentally flawed in some way. So those are four that account for a lot of the things that drive people to keep themselves limited within that upper limit.
Well, I've never really spent a lot of time exploring all of the details of it in my own case, but in terms of the insights that I was given on my own journey, because that's a pattern that I repeated all over the place in every aspect of my life, it was a variation of the final one. And in my case, it was because there were these gigantic flaws and there was something deeply wrong with me. If in my case, because I was playing the teaching game in a sense of sharing information and writing books and teaching and stuff, but also from a business perspective, that if I really achieved my full potential, then I would be very visible. And therefore, the odds that other people could discover these serious flaws would increase, and therefore the chance of something really terrible happening to me if the truth about the flaws ever really got out, kind of a thing. And I was aware, I'm sure it was more complicated than that, but that particular piece of it for me was a real big one. And I wasn't aware of it, obviously, for a long time. I just noticed that I kept having the up, down, up, down, up, down, and anytime anything started to get really good, the next thing you know, it would be undercut.
Yeah, well, that sounds like an exact example of what I'm talking about there, and you'd be surprised at how many incredibly successful people have that particular issue. I have some of that in myself too, and usually what happens is not all of us have all four of those fears, but usually what happens is people have one primary one and maybe another one also. So I had a lot of that fundamental flawed one, as well as a lot of burden in my background. And I can even remember saying to people, I'd be halfway through writing a book, and I'd say, oh, gosh, do I really need to finish this book? You know, it'll be just more parts of the Canadian forest that'll have to be cut down to make the paper for it. And do we really need another book like this? And later on, I realized it was just that sense of burden that I felt like if I did more things out in the world, it would just make me feel more burdened. And so once that began to clear up in my 30s and early 40s, it was quite remarkable to feel a sense of walking around in the world not as a burden, you know, to not feel that way. It was kind of like taking off a wet wool overcoat that I'd worn for 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, I couldn't even begin to describe the difference between the way I felt when I was burdened with that particular fear, just to use burdened, and when I began to notice it weaken and then ultimately drop away. It was extraordinary. And then you kind of think to yourself, geez, how could I have run that stuff for so many years and not really known what was going on, or if I knew what was going on, not be able to do anything about it? And it's an extraordinarily powerful thing. Now, you mentioned the four zones. Why don't you go into a little bit more detail on those?
Yes. Well, if you look at the activities of your life in a given day, you may see that some of them fall in this zone of incompetence, where you're doing things that you're not particularly good at. And a lot of us waste a lot of our time doing things we're not good at because we think we have to do them, or just because we're into punishing ourselves and keep doing things in our zone of incompetence so that we keep suffering going. But the second zone is the zone of competence, where you're doing things that you're good at. You can do them pretty well, but the key thing is somebody else could do them better than you, or somebody could do them faster than you or more proficiently than you. And some of us lock in on doing those things in our zone of competence and don't realize that they're blocking our ability to go higher into our zone of excellence and our zone of genius. The zone of excellence is where you're doing things that you're really good at, that you can do better than most people, or perhaps you're the best in your given company or your division at doing them. So you're functioning in a very excellent way. You're getting good things done, and you're probably making good money at it too. But, and I say this not only from discovering this in myself, but also working with a lot of very successful executives. Almost everyone in the business world gets stuck in their zone of excellence. And how that happens is it becomes kind of a reinforcing thing where you're excellent at something and people begin to depend on you to keep showing up with that skill or keep doing that particular thing in the family or in the organization you're in. And even though you're very good at it and you make good money doing it, it blocks your ability to open up to find your true genius, to find out what you're uniquely suited to do. And then a whole new world opens up when you begin to move into your zone of genius. In your zone of genius, you're doing things that you love to do. And when you're doing them, time disappears. You don't feel like you're working. Effort disappears. And so there also happen to be things that generate a largest ratio of revenues and contribution and abundance per time spent. You know, I've had any number of executives say to me that, oh, you know, if I could only just get 10 or 15 minutes to myself to think every day and to kind of drop out of the traditional business game for a few minutes or a half an hour to just kind of open up to that larger possibility. Well, that kind of thing in your zone of genius, that's the way you're living. It's not just 10 minutes at a time. Gradually, you can learn to spend more and more of your time in your zone of genius. So ultimately, in my research, I find that life is at its very best when you're spending at least 70% of your time in your zone of genius, doing the things that you're uniquely suited to do, the things that don't feel like work but produce huge results for you.
Now, is it your belief that this whole kind of upper limit and moving into the zone of genius, that it's kind of like a sequential thing? Or can you make some progress in moving into the zone of genius even if you're still struggling to one degree or another with the upper limit problem?
Oh, that is a great question. I appreciate you bringing that up because that's one of the things that a lot of people really don't understand very well. You don't have to make – it's not a linear kind of thing. You can be – even kind of solidly locked into your zone of competence, maybe not even in your zone of excellence, and all you need to do is start doing a minute or two more a day of things that are in your zone of genius, or 2 minutes, or 3 minutes, or 10 minutes. 10 minutes in your zone of genius will change your life, no question about it. So if you discover what's in your zone of genius and start doing just a little bit more of that every day, life takes on a whole new dimension. Life becomes much more effortless just as a result of doing that. Even though that, you know, 98% of your life may still look the same, everything begins to feel different.
Do you feel that most people know what their zone of genius is, or that a lot of people need to have help to be able to uncover it?
Well, I noticed in our seminars, I've been working with this material for many years in our seminars, long before I was able to figure out how to write the book about it. And I can tell you that for most people, it takes them some work to find out what their genius is. And we have processes that are in the book, The Big Leap, and also in our seminars that are designed to kind of help you home in on that. Like, for example, one of the questions that in The Big Leap in our seminars is, what do you most love to do? And trace that back to when you first were as a child doing something similar to that. Like, for example, one of the stories I tell in the book is how, like, to this day, I love being with somebody as they're solving some kind of problem or working out some solution in business, or I love facilitating people as they're opening up to their zone of genius. When I'm doing that, I love that, solving those kinds of problems. And if I trace that back to when I was a kid, there was a time when I was about 5 years old when I set up a big cardboard box in the corner of my grandma's living room, and that was my office, and I would commute to it on my tricycle, and I would sit there in my office, and people would tell me their problems. And this was imaginary people. Nobody in my family ever took me up on the offer, so they were kind of a stubborn bunch and didn't think they had any problems they needed to talk to, especially to a person who wore short pants. And so I had it all to myself most of the time, and so I would make up people with imaginary problems, and they would tell me those problems. So even back when I was 4 or 5 years old, there was a glimmer there of what I would later be able to develop into my whole zone of genius. So what we do in seminars is we invite people to ask themselves a series of questions that home them in on what their genius is and then how to apply it in their life.
Well, I'm just curious. I mean, just quick and dirty math, what percentage of people would you say absolutely know it coming into the room? And how many people, if you were to say, you know, tell them what zone of genius is and then say, what do you think yours is, really don't know?
I'd say about 3% know, by my rough calculation.
So it's really unusual.
It's pretty unusual, yeah. But it's interesting, within an hour of asking the right questions, almost everybody can home in on it and has a real clear sense of what it is that is in their zone of genius. So when you get to that part of the book out there, if you're reading the book, I really encourage you to slow down and take it easy through that part and really breathe your way through it so you really have a chance to inquire into it, because the same processes are in the book that we use in our seminars.
Yeah, and it's so easy in a book to just say, okay, I'll do that later, and just keep reading and move through it and then maybe not get back to it. So that's a wonderful suggestion. Is there anything that you haven't said that you want to say about Zone of Genius in terms of why it's so important and so transformational when you get clarity on it and make the commitment to spend more and more time in it?
Yes. What I've noticed, certainly in my own life, but also in working with people, is that life takes on a flowing quality once you're in your zone of genius. It has kind of it's not a chunky, linear kind of quality. It's more of a flowing, easeful quality, like you're being in the right place at the right time, or kind of the sea is opening up in front of you. So almost everybody reports that kind of a sensation that they begin to feel. And I particularly love that sensation, by the way. I like the feeling of going through my life feeling like it's flowing easefully. That's been one of the greatest treats of my life, is to discover ways to do that, because, you know, I can remember times in my life when it was not like that at all. It felt like I was either drowning in that sea or plunking along kind of in a rattly old pickup truck through life. And so it feels very delicious to feel that flow that you feel in the zone of genius. I also think it has powerful qualities on people's health as well as their happiness and well-being. Just in terms of my own life, the more I've spent time in my zone of genius over the past 20 years, it's pretty much illness has disappeared from my life. I haven't had a cold or a flu or anything in 10 or 15 years. And so it's just, you know, coming from a place where I used to get 3 or 4 colds a year, you know, flu once or twice a year, to suddenly have that kind of disappear. And I don't know if that's the only factor, but I do know that the more I spend time in my zone of genius, I just feel better physically, and people report back to me that that's the case too.
Very cool. And I can definitely identify with what you said about the feelings of slugging through life with all this resistance and all this, is, you know, the old saying goes, baggage that you're carrying. And then to be in that kind of flow and that sense of ease and joy with playing with stuff that you just love to do, and not there being any essence of it being work or struggle or pressure or any of that kind of stuff, but just a very light, joyous, fun, playing kind of a feeling.
I love that.
Let's talk about your conscious relationship work now. Why don't you start out with giving us a broad overview of what that term means?
Yes. When Kathleen and I got together almost 30 years ago, by the way, Katie is her name around the house, nickname for Kathleen. When Katie and I got together almost 30 years ago, we made a commitment. We'd been in different relationships in our 20s. We met each other when we were in our early 30s. And so we'd been in various kinds of relationships in our 20s, both of us, before we met each other, that, you know, had more or less success, but in my case, not very successful. None of them lasted for that long, and none of them certainly were a relationship where I could really grow with a person over a long period of time. And so when we got together, we were both aware of this, and after we met and fell in love, we decided to make our relationship a living laboratory of trying out different things that we could use that would allow us to live in a continuous state of positive energy with each other. And so that was our original inquiry. Would it be possible to live in a state of flow with each other? Would it be possible to live in a relationship that ran on positive energy rather than good argument, flow argument, you know, going back and forth between these two on-off kinds of things in the intimacy area? And I've never had anything that would even resemble that as far as a relationship goes. And neither had Katie, and so we decided we wanted to see if we could find out if that was possible. And so we were both psychologists, we were both therapists, and I was a professor at the time at the University of Colorado. I taught counseling students there for 21 years before I went out on my own. And so I was doing my professoring, and she was doing her full-time private practice. But at home, what we were really doing was trying to home in on what the skills were that allowed us to stay in flow all the time. And so one of the things we discovered was the power of being honest with each other about, you know, if one of us was afraid, saying, I'm scared, or if one of us was angry, saying, I felt angry about that, or if one of us was feeling sad, talking about feeling sad. So to be able to be direct and honest with each other solved a lot of our problems. It eliminated a lot of the jerky kinds of places in relationship. And so that was a big one. A second one, we took on the issue of eliminating blame from our relationship. Both of us come from family backgrounds where there's a lot of criticism and blame. And so we wanted to just see if we could invent something different. So we set the goal of eliminating blame from our relationship, blame and criticism. And it took us, you know, a number of years to eliminate it gradually, but we found that if we had this one move, we had this, whenever we would catch ourselves blaming the other person, as soon as possible, we would kind of point the finger back at ourselves, not in a blameful way, but saying, what was it about me that contributed to this argument? Or, what was I trying to learn here that I couldn't learn any other way? Or, what was going on with me that would make me start an argument right then? And it was really a challenge because, as you probably well know, when you're in the middle of something, some big argument, it really looks like it is the other person's fault. I mean, you know, it's pretty clear that the other person is the bad guy in that situation. And, of course, they're convinced that you're the bad guy. So to eliminate that took us a number of years. But now, you know, looking back on it, it was well worth because neither one of us have uttered a single critical word to the other one in so long. I can't even remember how to do it. It's been at least 10 or 15 years since one or the other of us have criticized the other. And so with that amount of space in the relationship where there's no critical energy going on, you know, we've written 9 or 10 books together and, you know, a million frequent flyer miles teaching our trainings and stuff. So you can get a lot done if you're not eating a lot of your energy up with criticism and blame. And the third thing that we found was that if we really focused in on our own creativity, then we didn't even get the urge to criticize or blame the other person. I think most criticism and blame in relationships is because one or the other person is not opening up to their own creative path and actualizing their own creative direction. Because if you're really opened up and consumed with your own creativity, you just don't have much interest in engaging in criticism and blame with other people. So I see almost all criticism and blame as being a symptom of not fully being committed to your own creative exploration. So we kept experimenting with that, and then we began to teach it to other couples and other therapists as it began to really work well. And then, you know, one day back in the late 80s or early 90s, Oprah Winfrey called, and we were on there with our first big book, Conscious Loving, and kind of everything has been wild since then. It's never really slowed down since a couple of visits on Oprah, God bless her. And it's been a process now of teaching the work to about 20,000 people in our seminars, and then a whole bunch more, of course, in our e-courses and our virtual life.
Now, have you experienced, just kind of tying back to where we started the call, I know the answer to the question, but more if there are specifics you want to share as to how dealing with the upper limit problem and spending more time in your zone of genius affects relationships?
Yeah, that is really a great thing to focus in on, because if both people in a relationship are willing to kind of take on handling their own upper limit problem, make a deal with each other that they're there for each other to support the other one moving through their upper limit, some real magic can take place there, because then both people are engaged in the process of kind of lifting the lid off their creative energy and establishing themselves in the zone of genius. And when you have two people doing that, it's just incredible energy, because you got both people that know what life is all about, really. It's all about opening up to your full creative flow inside yourself and then sharing that with other people so that it inspires them. And so once you kind of get into that flow, relationship dramas sort of lose their interest, you know, because it's kind of like you've already been there and done that, and it doesn't engage your interest any longer.
Cool. So we're just about out of time here. Is there anything else? We'll get to how can people contact you, but beyond that, is there anything else that you'd like to share with the folks listening to this about anything that we've talked about so far?
Well, I know that human change and human transformation is possible, you know, because before enlightenment struck me, I weighed 300 pounds and I smoked 3 packs of Marlboros and was in a crappy relationship and hated my job and didn't care much for my car either. And so I had everything wrong in my life when I was in my 20s. And boy, I'll tell you, to discover the key and be able to change all of that, plus have a life in which I was able to express my creativity, it feels like the greatest gift on earth, and I'm very grateful for that. So I am grateful for the opportunity to share it with you.
Cool. So if there's going to be a PDF that'll go with this series that'll have additional details, but contact details, but just so that we can get it on the recording here too. If somebody wanted to find out more, The Big Leap, they can get at any online or brick-and-mortar bookstore, right?
Yes, they can.
And if they want to find out more about your work in general or conscious relationships or whatever, where would you like them to visit?
The main place to go to is to our website, hendricks.com, and that's spelled HENDRICKS.com. And so that's kind of the jumping off place to all our different work.
Well, that's great. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you here and share your zone of genius with the folks who will be listening to this from my sphere of influence and beyond. And we'll look forward to, personally, our continually expanding friendship. So thanks for being here today. And I appreciate it very much, as I'm sure will those listening to it.
Good. Thanks a lot, Robert. My pleasure.
Robert Scheinfeld here with another episode of Chats with Fascinating People. Today I have a very fascinating individual whose name is Michael Oliver. And Michael and I met each other for the first time, I guess, maybe 6 months ago in San Francisco, and developed something of a mutual admiration society, liking each other personally, resonating with and honoring and respecting each other's work, both of our approaches to what we do being very unique in the marketplace. And we developed a connection, and so when it was time to do these chats, I definitely wanted to do one with Michael. And we're going to be talking about what Michael calls natural selling. Now, sales is what I call one of the 5 power centers of business. You know, there needs to be something going on to support the sales of products and services. And so it's a very important topic, and I'm very excited to have Michael available here to give his very unusual approach. So, Michael, welcome to the call.
Thank you, Robert. Appreciate being here.
So let's start out with the most obvious question, perhaps, which is, how does natural selling differ from other selling approaches?
Well, it's a radical difference. I guess the way to describe it is actually to compare with the conventional selling approach, the selling approach that most people are used to or think that you have to do. And we can look at that as a critical distinction between the two. And the critical distinction is that in conventional selling, you're taught systems and techniques that are designed to persuade people to do what you want them to do. That's a really important phrase to grab hold of, is that the systems and techniques are designed to persuade people to do what you want them to do. Now, you might say, well, so what? There might be anything wrong with that. There's no right or wrong in it. It's just that it causes a chain reaction of huge amount of resistance. So let me talk about the systems and techniques. For example, one system and technique is to present your features and benefits as soon as you can in front of an audience. That's one system and technique, which, interestingly enough, backfires most of the time because you're just guessing what features and to present and what those benefits might be, but we can talk about that later if you wish. Another system and technique is to close people, put pressure on them to close people. And another one is to handle their objections. So when they ask a question or make a comment or express some concern, you treat that in an aggressive move and you overcome or handle whatever they say as an objection. And these are conventional techniques, as I said, designed to persuade people to do what you want them to do and ironically create resistance. They cause the resistance that most salespeople don't want. And the opposite side of the coin of that is natural selling, which comes from a different way of thinking, a different mindset, if you like, which is based on the, if you like, the desire to serve, the desire to help, and talking with people in a way that allows them to persuade themselves. There's no external pressure. It just allows them to persuade themselves, if it's appropriate to do so, without using any manipulation, without using any techniques. And it's the difference between, and the difference between the two allows the salesperson to be more effective. It allows that salesperson to be very comfortable in the way that they're approaching people because they're no longer attached. And there's another key component. They're no longer attached to the end result. The end result will be the result of the way that they think. This is the way the salesperson thinks and the way that they approach the person, and the end result will actually magnify 10 times. The end result will work out to be 10 times better than what they would imagine, and at the same time they will feel comfortable doing it. And just one last thing is that natural selling does not cause rejection, does not cause objections, and so you don't have to learn objection handling techniques, and you do not have to learn how to create an armor around yourself because you're going to get rejected all the time. It's just impossible to be rejected in natural selling. So there's a mouthful there for you. You can play around with that one.
Well, you know, so many people use the term sales and selling, but truth be told, if you didn't need to use the word selling as part of what you do and you were just to use another label that would more accurately describe it, you'd actually call it something else, wouldn't you?
You could do, except I'm very comfortable with the word sale and selling in the context of where I'm coming from. And if you go back, you know, a few centuries and look up some the old words, you know, in the old dictionaries, you'll find that actually selling means to serve. There's a derivation of the selling means to serve. So if you want to change it, you could say that it's coming from a place of service. I mean, and true service. This is not about self-service. This is about coming from a place of purpose, which is probably a key component on this. Is like living a life of purpose and selling on purpose. And the purpose is to serve others. And if you know how to serve others, you will ultimately serve yourself and serve yourself in abundance. That's the key. You have to remove yourself from the equation. But unfortunately, most selling that's taught and most the techniques that are taught are based on the bottom line of being able to get that sale. And it's that getting that sale that causes most salespeople the problem of getting resistance from people and the problem within themselves because they can only take so much of it and will drag their feet when it comes to making contacts.
Well, and it's so interesting because I remember, and certainly I did not expand it to the degree that you have, but when I was in sales, which was, I would say, most of my 20s and then early 30s, before I shifted my focus to different forms of marketing, and it wasn't face-to-face kinds of selling stuff. I remember being in these rooms, and I remember being taught these things, especially some of the more heavy-handed and manipulative things, and just thinking to myself, number one, that's not my style. And number two, I just can't imagine why that would work. And then I found that when I was just doing exactly what you're talking about, which was interacting with people, finding out what it is that is going on with them, what they need help with, whatever it is, and that if I gave them, if I found out what was going on with them and I showed them, I call it inviting now. I wasn't that enlightened in my perspective at the time, that they would buy if it was really what would help them. And you were talking to the right people, and you just didn't need to do any of this kind of manipulative kind of stuff. And it was really, but I was kind of like the alien in the world thinking that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. You and I came from the same place. When I first started selling, I was very successful at selling in the conventional way and made a lot of money doing it in my first year. I was on 100% commission. I worked most of my life on commission. And I was 100% commission and made a lot of money and quite astounded myself. I've never seen that kind of money before. And I went through the process, but what I found was is that the conventional way of selling was so alien to me. And I thought that's what you had to do. I didn't have much option anyway because I'd done just about every single job underneath the planet and I was totally unemployable. And so selling was probably about the only thing that was left for me. And I would go up to people I respected and liked and admired and ask them, you know, surely there has to be a different way of doing this. And they said, no, this is the way you do it. This is the way we've always done it. It works. Get on with it. If you don't like it, then go and find something else. All the standard cliches and patterns that we have in life, and you probably recognize a few of those yourself just from your Busting Loose program, you know, the things that get drilled into us. And that it wasn't acceptable to me, though. For some reason or other, it just wasn't acceptable. And what I found out later was those techniques and systems do work. Obviously, they work. I mean, the economy works and so on. But it only works for a small number of people. And as far as being a salesperson, and it usually works for a certain personality style. And if you look at that personality style, they tend to be sort of driven or a driver. And they get on with it. They plow through things, plow through life. They don't let things get in their way and so on and so forth. And it doesn't really matter too much to them whether there's a lot of debris left behind because the focus is on getting the sale, the victories and getting the sale. That's why you get, you know, these titles called heavy hitters and it's all structured around the war program. You know, look at the word strategy and so on and so forth. And so there's this whole aggressiveness in it, and I couldn't understand it because I felt that if it was, which I had discovered earlier, problem-solving exercise, why is it, you know, that you had to battle with people? Why is it you had to force them to a close, handle their objections 7 times, wear them down until you got the sale, only then to have to deal with the potential of, you know, buyer's remorse afterwards and having to pay back the money because you'd forced them into the sale and they woke up next morning thinking, you know, damn it, I didn't want to do this. And so you and I had gone through the same thing, and I questioned some people about it, and they said, well, this is the way it goes. Except I noticed, and was very fortunate to notice, that there are a couple of people, one person in particular, who was doing something different. And he was making the same amount of money as I was and putting in less effort. And he was making, how can I put it, 4 times less effort than I was doing. He was spending time for himself and so on. And I asked him what he was doing. He couldn't tell me. And he invited me along to a couple of meetings that he was doing. And this is selling solar systems in Southern California. And I couldn't detect what he's doing, but here's what he didn't do. He didn't present. It was very, very little presentation. He didn't close, and there was no objections. And he walked away both times with contracts, both between $40,000 and $50,000. This is 20 years ago. And I asked him again after. I said, how do you do this? And he couldn't explain it. And I realized then that he had what was known as an unconscious competence. In that he was good, but he didn't know why he was good. And that was my first clue. That was my very, very first clue. And I decided then that there had to be a method to what he was doing. There had to be a method, and even though he couldn't explain it. And that was, in a sense, sort of in the background and in the foreground, my life's purpose. I didn't really know it at the time, but that's what I was seeking. And I went through a process of, counselor selling, asking questions where things came more clear to me, through other processes, all to do with asking questions. But here was the big difference between their programs, you know, such as the Xerox program. There's another one there, for example. The big difference between all their programs and natural selling is that they all attached to the bottom line. It was all about asking questions which were sequenced and geared towards getting the sale. And so you still had and met with the same resistance of rejection, the same resistance of objections. And the critical difference here is that in natural selling, you don't get attached to the bottom line. In fact, here's the irony. You let go of the bottom line. You do totally the opposite of what you're told to do, which is really hard for corporations to grasp and understand because they're so bottom line oriented. And here we are now empowering the salesperson saying, go in there and don't even think about making the sale. Of course, you start off thinking about making the sale, but you basically shelve it. You put it on the side. It comes secondary to the whole process. You know, and you talk about your experience there, Robert, about inviting people. Here's what natural selling does, and here's what I ask a question about is, how would you like to have people invite you to make a presentation? How would you like them to actually ask you informally or formally to make a presentation to them so that, in fact, they give you permission right away to do that? Not right away, but sometimes a bit down the line. So this is the way that natural selling approaches things. So we're talking sort of rather esoterically just a little bit at the moment, but I think it's important to get some background so as to get the idea of the concept, so that I think the concepts really work well in as far as the thinking is concerned. I think you'll agree with that.
And the other thing, too, that I'm sure you noticed with this guy that you just talked about, as well as the thousands of people that you've worked with since and in your own life, I mean, I know I have, is that it also just makes the whole experience so much more fun.
Yeah.
You get extraordinary results, but you're having fun in the process, not instead of feeling like you're dealing with going against your own resistance to the established ways of doing things and noticing your own resistance or discomfort or whatever, instead of being in a much more flowing, natural way yourself and enjoying the whole process and looking forward to it.
Very much so. I mean, it does. I mean, and here's a feeling, a couple of feeling expressions, if you like. You know, the conventional way of looking at selling is on the basis of, you know, when you pick up the phone or you're going to talk with someone or meet with someone, is really the focus or the mindset, the thinking is of this. It's about, you know, about closing the sale, you know, that I want to increase my business today. Therefore, you know, I must go out and prospect as many people as possible and close them and do business with them. It's all a personal thing. It's all about an inward thing which creates tension. And there's a saying, you know, when I focus on me, I increase my intention, my tension, sorry. When I focus on you, I decrease my tension. And so the conventional way of thinking is, you know, is to go out and prospect people to make a sale. The natural selling way of thinking is to go out and talk with people. Big difference, not prospect, but talk with people to discover if they have the types of problems that we can help them solve. And it's a different energy. Now, the conventional sellers say, well, yes, that's obvious. That's what we do as well. And it's true that they do. I mean, the whole idea, if you go through the questioning process, is that you are discovering if they have the types of problems that you can help them solve, because with problems comes opportunity. Opportunity for both people. Opportunity for them to have their problems solved. Opportunity for us, because when we can create income or create whatever it is that we're looking for. But again, the difference between the natural selling thinking is that in natural selling, we're not attached to the sale. We're attached to the idea. If you want to get attached to anything, we're attached to the idea of focusing on two objectives. And one is, you know, is discovering and allowing the other person to freely talk about the difference between what they have and what they want. because if there is no difference, then there is no problem and there is no sale. As simple as that. So it's allowed them to talk about the difference between what they have and what they want, so as to surface the potential problem. To allow them to talk about why they want it, because because the why part is the emotional part, is the real essence of why people want to change. And it doesn't matter whether it's a technical problem or whether it's a personal problem. That's the real essence, the why part of it. And then the second thing, the first part is to have that conversation. The second thing is to discuss the level of desire person you're talking with, the level of desire to make a change. Because you have to establish that. If you don't establish that, then you're going to walk along a rocky road. And so you're helping that person, if you like, through asking questions and listening really intently, without getting in their way and without getting in your way. You're listening, allowing them to talk about the history of what's going on, which is happening in the present moment, and you're allowing them to express their desire to make a change. And that expression of desire to make a change cements home their level of, if you like, potential commitment to take action. And when you approach a person like this, without using sales techniques, without even saying things like, when a person says to you something effective, we've had a problem with past suppliers because of this, you don't jump in and say, well, you won't find that with us because we've got warranties or we got this or we got that. You don't say anything like that. You keep your mouth shut, you listen, you store the information, and you reflect it and model it back again later on. You rephrase it and you model it back later on. And so you don't get in your own way, you don't get in their way. So it's a lot of clues as to the thinking and the approach when you're talking with somebody. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like you to say a little bit more about the last piece that you just gave, which is how anxious are they to solve the problem? Because, again, that's an interesting thing, and another major difference, as I see it with your work, is that so many systems, you find out if they have a problem, and if they have the problem, you pounce on it. But they don't ever take the time to say, okay, we acknowledge that there's the problem. We acknowledge that, I may have a way to help you with that, but where are you in terms of anxiousness to solve the problem right now, kind of a thing, and how important that is and how much more effective it makes everything when you have that piece. So talk a little bit more about that, if you would.
Well, there's a sort of preemptive thing on that, because in what I call the discovery stage, there are five different stages of a natural selling dialogue. And it is pure dialogue, by the way. This is something Socrates did 2,300 years ago. Probably the most spiritual, the best salesperson that the world has ever known, because he didn't get in his own way. He listened to others, and he responded to others in a different way than we respond. So it's a dialogue that we actually have, the pure essence of a dialogue. When you've allowed the other person to speak, the potential client or potential customer to speak, you move towards finding about this level of desire, which will surface during the conversation most of the times, during the discovery stage. And as I mentioned, I said there are five stages. There's the connecting stage, which is a very brief opener. You don't have to go through a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for, rapport building. The rapport building is actually done in the discovery, in the interview, if you like, in the second stage, the discovering stage. And you, near the end, once you've got all the facts and you've got all the reasons as well, because there's two parts to this. You have to get facts as well as the reasons behind what's going on and what's not working, what is working, why a person wants to make a change. You do a summation. And so you get to a point where you actually repeat back and say, well, let me see if I've got this right. And you repeat back to that person what you think you've heard, because you might have interpreted some of their stuff in your own mind. You might not have understood something. So it's important to get full understanding. And even if you get it wrong in the repeating back, the fact that you attempted to repeat it back draws that person closer to you, literally pulls them closer to you, because they'll correct you, not in a nasty way. What they'll do is they'll correct you to help you to understand them better, because that's your whole intent in the first place, to understand them. So that draws them to you. So that increases the desire to, first of all, to do business with you, and increases the desire to make the change because they feel as though they're talking with a competent person. And here's the irony, another irony, is that you said nothing. You said nothing about your business, unless you've been asked to. You said nothing about how you can solve this issue. Excuse me for a moment. I just need to clear my voice. But through asking questions, you come across as a very clever person. So that draws to you. So you summarize. You say, look, based on what I've heard you say, this is where I understand what your problem is, and this is how it's affecting you, and this is what you'd like to do, and this is what it's going to do for you if you manage to solve this. And you do a summation. It's almost like a presentation, but you do a summary there. And they say yes or no, that's correct. And then you ask a question, you say, well, is there anything else that we should add to this? And they'll add some more. So you always open up, keep it open, they'll add some more. And then you basically bring it to closure at that point with a qualifying question. And you can ask a question and say, well, look, let me ask you, how important is it to you to have this problem solved, first of all, and how soon do you want it done? And that is a very simple question that you can ask. And you can ask it if you go through the discovery process like I advocate. You can ask it anyway, but if you ask it too soon and you do ask it using conventional selling techniques, you'll basically get an answer, but it'll be a resistant type of answer because they know what you're doing. But they're so relaxed with you through a discovering process that they'll tell you. And they'll say something to the effect of, well, you know, I've had this happen. I didn't realize how important it was until I spoke with you. And I'm beginning to realize that I really do have to do something about it. So I would say, you know, we're going to have to move on this fairly quickly. That's not uncommon to get that kind of response. And so you can tell that you've helped them elevate their desire to make a change. And then you follow that and transition into presenting, and transitioning being the third stage of natural selling. You then transition and say something's effect of, and you say this a lot of different ways. Well, the reason I was asking is that I believe that we can help you solve your problem, or I believe that I can help you solve your problem. And if you'll permit me, what I'd like to do is spend the next 5 or 10 minutes going over what you've told me and how we can specifically deal with those issues so that you can move on with whatever it is you want to do. Okay, so that is in itself an invitation to be invited. You know that part you were talking about earlier where you said you like to invite people? You're actually inviting them. And when they say, yes, please, go ahead, they have now invited you to make that presentation, as opposed to the conventional selling approach, which is to attempt to make that presentation right at the beginning. In natural selling, the presentation comes towards the end because all the work is done in the discovery phase. All the work of trust, rapport, understanding, attraction is all done in the discovery phase. They bought you, and they bought everything you represent, because buying you is really important. And then you present your solution based on what they told you. And you present the correct features, because now you know what features to present. And you present them as advantages, because you know how to talk about them as advantages. Okay. And then most importantly, you know how to present them as benefits, because benefits are very personal to that person. Because the benefit is how it makes a person feel. And a person will express to you how they feel during the conversation. So you're able to now talk in terms of benefits. And at the end of that, you've got it. It'll be very, very hard to beat you, anyone to beat you, if you go through that kind of process.
So the bottom line on all of this, what would you say is the most valuable skill that you would want to learn if it's not something you're skilled at now, or to enhance if you have some skill with it in order to apply your model?
I would say there are two things. The first skill is listening, knowing how to listen. Listening without interruption, listening emphatically. And, you know, to quote a yogi, a gentleman by the name of Amrit Desai, he said, you know, true listening happens when you're neither expecting nor judging. That is the real key thing to go through, okay? True listening happens when you're neither expecting nor judging. And so that would be one thing. Now, along with that comes the ability to ask questions. And there are certain types of questions. In fact, in my book, I talk about it. In Natural Selling, I talk about there are seven different types of questions that you can ask. But more importantly, you're listening to the answers for these questions. It's not so much the questions, it's listening to the answers. So that's the first thing. The second thing is detachment, is detaching from the outcome. And I have an expression for that, which is, you know, if you let go of the outcome, you'll increase your income. And the outcome is the need or the expectation of making a sale. Actually, expectation is not exactly the right word, because there is an expectation, but it's not an ego expectation. It's just a natural understanding that you are going to make the sale. But you're not attached to the sale. It doesn't matter if you don't make the sale of this person, you'll make it with somebody else. Because you can't help everyone. You know, it's not about closing people. It's just understanding that you can't help everyone. Not everyone perhaps needs your solution right now. Perhaps it's not the right time. But detachment is really, really important. So detaching from the outcome. And as I said earlier, if you want to get attached to something else, which is really discovering if there is a sale to be made in the first place.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that so many people feel is counterintuitive or impossible or whatever else you want to call it. But this is something that I've experienced so much in my Busting Loose work, is that when you do, and you can't do this as a mental exercise, you have to make some significant internal changes. You can't just say, all right, well, I'm going to detach now. You know, I mean, it's an experiential kind of a thing, but it's really ironic and somewhat counterintuitive that when you let go of the objective and you let go of everything being about the objective, and, you know, you can't achieve a goal if you don't set it, and all these other kinds of things that we hear, magic happens because it enables you to do all the things that you just talked about in a very, let's just call it, sincere and authentic way, which is picked up.
Very much so. It sort of puts a lot of goal-setting techniques on their ear, because what it's actually saying is that you can set your goal, you can set your objective, which might be, let's say it's personal income. Maybe you want to make, $100,000 a year, for example, $500,000, $1 million, whatever it is. You set your objective. It's like climbing a mountain, you know, you want to climb to the peak. That in fact is your in some more spiritual terms, it's more about setting your intention. That is your intention. And in fact, if anyone's familiar with Deepak Chopra's work, Seven Spiritual Laws of Success, one of the laws talks about the law of intention and desire. And the intention is more of the factual, logical things, such as setting the $100,000 goal or setting the idea that you want to reach the peak of the mountain. The desire is a feeling that you bring forward to want to do this, okay? Because you have to have the desire, otherwise you're not going to make it. So the desire, there has to be desire there. But the process itself is a step-by-step process, and you don't have to look at that goal anymore. You don't have to look at that peak. You've already set the intention. And so, in fact, what you're doing is you're looking ahead of you step by step by step. And you can take detours as well. I mean, sometimes the detours are very useful to take. And sometimes the detours are accidental detours, and sometimes detours that, in a sense, you might not have wished to have happened, but you can learn from them as you move along. And so it does. It puts everything on its ear. Because you let go of the attachment of getting to the top, and next thing you know, you're at the top. Next thing you know, you've got the 100,000, and it happens very, very rapidly, because as you said, it's an experiential thing. But as an experiential thing, you start experiencing it by becoming aware of the process, and so it's an intellectual thing to begin with, and so eventually it becomes something that becomes just part of you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we're almost out of time, so what I'd like to do is, if somebody wants to learn more about it, about your work, You mentioned the book. Is it available, you know, at Amazon and all kinds of booksellers, or should they go to a certain place if they want to get a copy?
Yeah, it's available at Amazon, and it's also available from my website, which is naturalselling.com. And go to just the two words, naturalselling.com. And the book itself, and I have CDs as well, is geared towards the network marketing industry, which I'm a proponent of, and I think that it's a paradigm that has met its time. I think that more and more people are going to get involved in this, and I've been training network marketers for the last 10 or 12 years on this very, very different approach than what they're normally taught, and it's called How to Sell Network Marketing Without Fear, Anxiety, or Losing Your Friends. And again, that can be obtained by going to naturalselling.com. And you can also get a lot of other information there as well. And whether you're involved in network marketing, by the way, this applies to direct sales. It's not just network marketing. I could have called the book, you know, how to be in direct sales, or how to build your business faster, or how to make more sales faster without fear, anxiety, or losing your friends. So it's to deal with all aspects of selling. So don't look upon it just as network marketing. And on my website, too, is a free e-course called 7 Steps to Natural Selling. And it's all clearly laid out on the navigation bar. And I also write weekly a newsletter. It's a free newsletter called Oliver's Twist to Selling. So my last name being Michael Oliver, so I just throw that in there. But Oliver's Twist to Selling. And I give my angle on selling, things I hear, questions that people have, and so on and so forth. And it's part of my ongoing training. Because obviously I can't be there for everyone every time, but it's helpful hints every week as to how to rethink and retool your brain so that you can come from this intuitive, what you call counterintuitive, but I think really in my mind is the real intuition. You know,
yeah.
It's counterintuitive to the conventional way of thinking, but the reality is it's the real intuition, and that's where I'm coming from. And that's where you're coming from, and I think that's why we enjoy each other so much.
Yeah, so you have the book, and you have some CDs, a course kind of a thing, and then you also do live trainings. And is there anything else that is a way that somebody could get the information if they wanted to?
Those are primarily the best ways. I have a CD as well, if anyone's looking at the book and wants something else. There's a CD called 12 Ways to Start Effective Conversations Without Fear. And it's actually at the discovery stage. You mentioned 5 stages of the natural selling dialogue framework, and it actually helps people understand how to approach people in different situations, how to explain what it is that you do, how to explain your products in a way that doesn't sort of tell people what it is that you do, but how what you do helps other people. Very critical difference there. So you don't, if someone says, what do you do? You say, I'm a doctor. There's a way of explaining that actually describes how being a doctor helps certain people, and it puts you in a very different light than most other people. So so there's a lot of other information. There are other CDs as well. That's pretty much it. I do workshops, seminars, travel around the world, and I set up my own workshops and get invited to events and so on. So, yes, I'm here to help as many people as possible to understand this wonderful profession called selling and change most people's idea of what that is and allow them to step into it themselves so that it works for any kind of personality. It doesn't matter who you are.
Well, and the other thing I just wanted to add before we officially close is that I've seen Michael present to audiences 2 times, and there were a lot of people in the audiences that were very passionate about their product or their service and very passionate about wanting to help people. And not the kind of personality type that Michael talked about that just kind of plows through whatever, trying to achieve their goals and not being concerned about debris. But at the same time, very uncomfortable about what you just said about your audio, initiating a conversation with a potential client, and then just the whole thing about the sales process, very uncomfortable with it. And I saw within a matter of a relatively short period of time, as Michael revealed the nuts and bolts of the natural selling system, I'll just call it, the transformations in these people, and it was almost like I hated this process before, and now I love it. I mean, just speaking very generally, there was a very radical shift in, now there's other people that don't have that issue. They would just like to be more effective. But I'm just talking about if you're starting out with someone that's uncomfortable with the whole sales process, and with a very short period of time, this radical transformation to feeling comfortable with it, knowing what to do, it not being such a mystery, no longer struggling with this whole thing about having to manipulate people or push people or use tricks or whatever. It was extraordinary what I saw in seeing Michael really revealing the whole system. And so if this is something that's part of your business and career dynamic, I would like to strongly encourage you to check out Michael's work in more detail, because it's just extraordinary and what can change in the dynamic, both with the results, the income, and your experience of the whole thing.
Thank you, Robert. I appreciate you saying that.
So thank you for your time, Michael. This has been great. And
thank you.
I appreciate you spending the time with us. And again, naturalselling.com, and you'll also be getting a written document along with these chats that'll repeat that as well, too, if you don't write it down or whatever. So thanks again, Michael. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Robert, and all the best with your own work. It's very valuable, and I found extremely, extremely revealing and very useful to me. So all the best to you, and speak with you again soon. Thank you.
Robert Scheinfeld here with another episode of Chats with Fascinating People. Today I have Michael Port, who I met because we share the same publisher, and we also share some similar passions for thinking big and going, not just thinking outside the box, but what I call dynamiting the box. So welcome to this interview, Michael.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
So tell me about what you call the Think Big Manifesto.
The Think Big Manifesto is my fourth book, and it is a call to action. It is a call to action for what I call the Think Big Revolution. Now, I know that seems big and maybe even a little delusional, this idea of a group of people, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people coming together to do big things in the world. But I think that, you know, when you want to do something big, you want to do something new, there's so many challenges that you face. I mean, really, so many, from intellectual challenges to emotional challenges to, you know, practical application challenges of, you know, whatever you're trying to create. And it's very difficult to do it alone. Very, very difficult to do it alone. And I think that if we are surrounded by other big thinkers, if we are supported by other big thinkers, we'll do a lot more. And so I created something called thinkbigrevolution.com, which is a free social networking site. And thousands of members are in there, all big thinkers. And it's a place where you can go and start your revolution around whatever you believe is important, whatever you want to stand for, whatever you want to change, either within yourself, your community, or, you know, the world around us. And you can go and post manifestos, you know, you can write blogs, you can put videos and pictures and start discussion forums, you can post events. And, of course, you can join other revolutions in progress, you know, based on what you believe. If someone else is doing something that's important to you, you go join and help in their cause. But we needed a manifesto. We needed something to get us ready to play this big game. And that's what the Think Big Manifesto is. It is the call to action for a revolution, a personal revolution, a professional revolution, and also a political revolution, but, you know, not a red state, blue state type of politics, but the type of politics that I just mentioned. Plato's politics talked about how groups make decisions, about how groups do things in the world together, and that's what ultimately we need to learn more about.
So in the book, there's education in terms of if there's something that you're really passionate about, how to go about bringing that passion in a much bigger way to the world?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. This is my fourth book, and the first three books were all on different business topics. So my first book, Book Yourself Solid, was a marketing book for small business owners. My second book, called Beyond Booked Solid, which is a systems development and a management book for small business owners. And then my third book was called The Contrarian Effect. And it's about why it pays big to take typical sales advice and do the opposite. So you see, I've written three business-type books. But ultimately, what I've found is that
there's a certain code that big thinkers follow, whether it's in business or in the arts or whatever, you know, whatever it is you're pursuing. It's not a blueprint. It's not a secret. You know, it's not like, you know, something that you've, you know, got to pay $1 million for and, you know, someone's going to fix you and, you know, you'll have all the answers. There's just an inherent natural order to big thinking. There's no right first step or last step, but I make the case for big thinking and offer a code which we can follow in whatever way is, you know, is right for us. And so there are certain things that we need to address and then ways of being that we need to adopt if we want to do big things in the world. So, for example, something very, very simple but so incredibly important, the idea of getting comfortable with discomfort. It's just one piece of the code, but if you want to do something big in the world, if you want to bust loose from the money game or bust loose from the business game, you know, if you want to do things differently, if you want to do something you've never done before, well, there may be some discomfort associated with that. You may run into things that you've never, you know, experienced before, and that's going to be hard. And most of us, and it's a natural, you know, neurological response to run away from discomfort, most of us will run away from the discomfort. But if you want to do big things in the world, how are you going to do them if you're running away from discomfort? So I talk about how to get more comfortable with the discomfort that you're going to feel when you're doing big things in the world. Or, for example, something as simple as creating habits of commitment making and fulfilling. It seems so simple, but this is what big thinkers excel at, and people who fall victim to their small thinking have not yet mastered the ability to make commitments and fulfill them. Small commitments and big commitments. If you don't make big commitments and then go about fulfilling them, nothing's going to happen. If you make really big commitments and don't fulfill them, then certainly nothing's going to happen and nobody's going to want to play with you again. But then every single day you're making what seem like small commitments and then fulfilling them, and then the aggregate of all those small commitments add up to your big thing. And oftentimes in the pace that we live, this sort of very fast-paced, you know, life that we live, we barely feel like we can, you know, get 1/100th of our to-do list done. And so we're saying, oh, yeah, sure, I'll try to get to that, or I'll try to get to that, or we'll see about that, and, you know, I hope I can do that. And when we live in that kind of space, we're not going to really do a lot. We've got to be very, very good at making commitments and fulfilling them.
So would you say that it would be, I'll just use the term for lack of a better word, more supportive to people to get the book first, read it, and then go to the website and participate with the social dynamics, or are they really kind of separate things?
I'd say either one. Certainly, I think people sometimes like to go over to the website because they like to poke around and see what's going on and see if the environment resonates with them, and then, you know, decide if they want to go pick up a copy of the book. Or they go right to the book so that they have this really great framework, this great structure about how to interact with other people around doing big things, because this is such an important issue. You know, I write a monthly column for Entrepreneur Magazine, and the article that I just finished up is for the September issue, and I wrote it on the two greatest sales books ever written. And, you know, they're not the titles that anybody would ever think of when they think of sales books. The two greatest sales books ever written are a book called Emotional Intelligence and a book called Social Intelligence, both by Dan Goleman. They're psychology and sociology books about the study of brain science and human behavior and human interaction. And so what I'm trying to do with the Think Big Manifesto is offer that kind of thinking in a way that is easy to consume, although it may take work to, you know, to live this way, but you understand it, where sometimes when you read, you know, books like Social Intelligence, you're like, what the heck is this guy talking about? You know, because it's very, very scientific and academically oriented. And so that's what I try to do here, because you need to have a framework and a way of being to do big things in the world. We're interpretive beings. That's what makes us special. That's what makes us different. And the way that we interpret the world around us and the way that we interpret our place in the world is going to affect the actions that we take, which, of course, then affects the results that we get. And if you read most self-help, they'll tell you, well, here's what you should do differently. Here's what you should do differently. Here's what you should do differently. But if you attempt to do things differently but haven't changed the way that you interpret the world or world around you, those new actions aren't going to stick. So you're not going to be able to get different results. You're not going to get the results that you want. You have to go back to the more fundamental place of interpretation. How do I see the world? How do I see my place in it? Because those views will allow you to make the kind of changes that will allow you to take actions that will create the kind of results you want, but those actions will stick. And that's what's so important. And that's what the Think Big Manifesto does. It offers a way of being based on a way of interpreting the world that is big, that is abundant, that is expansive in its thinking. And big thinking is not necessarily about more. Sometimes it's actually about stripping away the fat layers of persona that we've wrapped ourselves around, you know, in, or living a simpler life. It does not necessarily require that you subscribe to the Donald Trump way of big thinking. That is his way of big thinking. It's fine, but it's not my way of big thinking. Each one of us need to define what it means to think big. And I think we start with the way that we see ourselves in the world, our place in the world, the value that we can bring to others, the experiences that we can that we can have access to, and all the time living in a from the perspective of full self-expression, being free, fully self-expressed, big thinkers that contribute to society.
So would you say that that's then your definition of big thinking?
Absolutely.
Full self-expression, that's
simple? Full self-expression. And sometimes when you start, I mean, you know, I use very strong language, manifesto, revolution. I do think that there is a battle going on both inside our heads and out in the real world with other people around small thoughts. You know, there are a lot of small thoughts that, you know, that play on a track in our head. And what we need to do every single day is get up and be willing to do battle with those small thoughts, to change how we respond to the cues that our neurology, our brain is offering us. And so that's a big part of big thinking. I think a big thinker is somebody who gets up every day and is willing to fight that good fight, and not continue to say, no, I know that. I know how that works. I know how that works. I know how that works. But rather to show up and say, I don't know, but I'm willing to learn. And you're going to be going up against, you know, others who are stuck in small thinking patterns. You want to change something in your family. You want to change something in your work environment. You want to do something that, you know, nobody that you know has ever done before. You know, there are a lot of people who are going to, you know, rear up and say, hey, don't think you can do it. I don't want you to do it. You shouldn't do it. That's wrong. That's not right. You suck. You're stupid. That's going to happen when you are revolutionary in your thinking. And at first, you know, you may just want to rebel and revolt against them, or you may just want to, you know, shut down completely. But we have to be willing to do good, righteous, peaceful battle with small thinkers outside of us and the small thinkers, the small thoughts that are within our head. But here's the thing. To me, this idea of the Think Big Manifesto, or the Think Big Revolution, rather, is a one-way revolution, meaning it takes from no one and gives to everyone. Because when you engage in a debate with somebody who, you know, is offering small thoughts in opposition to your big thoughts, and you rid them of these small thoughts, if you're able to win that, you know, revolutionary battle, that peaceful battle, they have no choice except to then think big, because thoughts must be replaced. So if your small thoughts are overthrown, are demolished, rather than letting in new small thoughts, you are much better served to let in big thoughts. So this revolution is very one way. As we go out in the world trying to encourage others, trying to inspire others to think big, then hopefully we'll be ridding them of their small thoughts and they'll be replacing them with big thoughts. And I think one of the single most important act of any one individual thinking big is helping others to think big, is inspiring others to think big, because then you now raise your level of accountability to to the lifestyle of big thinking. And, of course, you're adding value to society as a whole.
Well, it may seem obvious, especially to you, because you've studied this so much, but give me some specific examples, including some that maybe aren't so obvious necessarily, of small thinking that we have in our own self-talk, not that somebody around us might say, but that we would say to ourselves.
Oh, sure. Well, for example, you know, there's an insidious, there are a lot of insidious, even pernicious thoughts that maintain the illusion that small thinking is right thinking. Because obviously, you know, you wouldn't continue to think the small thoughts if you just thought they were wrong. You think they're right. But it's an illusion most of the time. So, for example, the small idea that what we have done in our past will not allow us to do any more in our future, right? That our past is the most important indicator of what we are going to be able to do in our future. That is a small thought. It is not a right thought, but it is a small thought that many people have committed to, and it maintains this illusion that small thinking is right thinking. So we have to break with that particular habit. We have to reprogram ourselves to a certain extent. The small idea that winning requires a loser. Now, if you're playing, you know, a soccer game, somebody is going to score more than the other person, but you're playing a game. This is not life. It is a game in life that you have fun. And even if you lose the game, you might still have enjoyed playing, even though you would have rather won. You know, I'm a competitive athlete, so I like to win at the games I play. But I don't think it was worthless to play if I didn't get the highest score. Or, you know, because in business we often think that, you know, the only way to go about doing, you know, big things is to be competitive, you know, to follow the dog-eat-dog mentality. To win at other people's expenses. And maybe, you know, we buy into the idea of cooperation, but, you know, it's often tit for tat, quid pro quo. You know, it's okay if you win, but I have to win as much as you. You can't win more than me. Again, it's a small thought that maintains the illusion that small thinking is right thinking, but it's not true. If you and I do something together and we both win, but you win 1,000 times more than me, that should make me happy, right? So, you know, these are just a few of the small thoughts that, you know, run through our mind all the time that maintain this, you know, illusion that small thinking is right thinking. Or maybe, how about, you know, does anybody ever feel, you know, if you're listening now, do you ever feel like, you know, what you have is not enough, you know, to do big things? I don't know enough. I don't have enough. I'm not enough. And maybe even what I have is shameful because it's not as much as other people. It's a small thought. And it's not a true thought. Is not a right thought. What you have is more than enough. In fact, you are more than you think. And you can do more with less than you think. That is true. There, you know, one of the things that you'll find in people who have really pursued mastery, who are real, true, you know, examples of big thinking, they are the first people to say, I don't know, but I'm willing to learn. Whereas the novice is always the one who says, oh, no, I know how to do that. Let me show you. So a great leader is able to hold contradictory thoughts in their mind at the same time and still be able to function very, very well. So you can pursue mastery. You can be a big thinker. You can do extraordinary things and still be very comfortable with not knowing a lot. And even being comfortable with having your ideas questioned, even being comfortable with, you know, with changing your ideas or the way that you see something or realizing, oh, that didn't work, let's do it a different way. Big thinkers are very comfortable with that way of being, where the small thinker will say, I know. So if, you know, some of these small thoughts that really hold us back are this idea that we need to be married to, you know, to a particular idea, that there is one way to do it. You know, once I'm this particular political, you know, persuasion, I can't change because that's just not how it's done. Or, you know, once I, you know this, that's, you know, that's all there is. Or I don't know this and I'm never really going to be able to know this and I don't have enough. So you can, you know, there's both sides of that coin. And I think it's another small thought that will just get in our way time and time again.
Well, we're almost out of time here. So if somebody wants to, we mentioned the website for the social website, the Think Big Manifesto. But why don't you repeat that again? And then if there's another website, there's going to be a text document that's going to go along with these audios that'll give repeat the contact information. But just so that we have it here on the audio, what other resources within your sphere of influence would you like people to check out?
Well, certainly thinkbigrevolution.com is a great place to go and join in the movement. But also you can check out michaelport.com. That's michaelport.com. And you see tons and tons of resources, free chapters from all my books, and all sorts of cool stuff that you can play with there. So that's what I would say. But I would love to leave you with just a couple quick thoughts. And I just think it's really, really important to remember that that big thinking is always worth the expenditure of energy. And it does take work. But because the only reward that comes from small thinking is paid in the common currency of small thinking, which is unaccomplished dreams. That's the currency of small thinking, unaccomplished dreams. So big thinking is always worth the effort or the energy. And look, small thoughts will fear the future. There's no doubt about it. And they will fight to keep you where you are now. But big thoughts are the future. So small thoughts will say no. Big thoughts will say yes.
Very cool. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it very much. And as you know, I wish you well with everything that you're doing, particularly this project, which I find to be extremely exciting and inspiring myself.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate being here. Really, really, really happy for the opportunity.